Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio. Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Doom, doom, doom.
What?
Welcome to Foreign National on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm one of your co-hosts, Eric Brunner-Yang, here with my lovely life partner, Pixeta Nat.
Hello there.
And today is our guest wife. You're always great at introducing the guests, so I'll let you knock this out.
All right, well, I hope I actually get this one completely right because, you know, just like with Lou, we kind of don't focus on what our friends actually do. We just know that the conversations around them are always brilliant. So this is Adriel Lewis. He is a curator for APA, Smithsonian APA. We are so excited about having him here just to be able to kind of sit you down and really dissect you because it's sometimes always in passing or during the exhibit that we had. But the work that you do to represent the Asian conversation in art and in the Smithsonian as far as culture and art goes. So thank you for being here.
Yo, hello. Excited to be here.
Yeah, we're really excited. My wife has been pulling some amazing guests. I think I've only contributed one, but she's been killing it.
You are an amazing guest every day.
You're funny. Valentine's
Day. I listen to every episode and yeah, I'm digging it. So I'm so honored to be like in like pilot season.
Yeah. All right. So let me tell you a little bit about the show. So we call this show Foreign National, which obviously has its own, you know, meaning and definition. And I think it typically, you know, is about people that move to other places and re-identify as those places as their homes. And then also for our show, Foreign National, it's a little bit about the food, what I think the food story in America is, especially when it comes to its cultural nuances and its identity. Where, for example, you know, Chinese food has been in this country for over 200 years, and I feel like Chinese food in general is a big part of just American food and American history. And that's kind of what Brothers and Sisters represents is my interpretation of Western food through an Eastern identity. And so for Foreign National, we will touch a little bit about food. I think we'll ask you a little bit about food. I think that's what people would expect because of what I do for a profession. But it's really about how stories and the ones that you'll tell today and based on your background and what you do, mm-hmm. how that shapes American culture and how that ends up shaping food in America.
Word. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you've done some traveling, and I've been following some of your pop-up exhibits, your culture labs that you do, that one in Hawaii, and that the old supermarket.
Beautiful.
But tell us about the first culture lab that you did.
Yeah, first let's talk about your work.
Uh-huh.
And then
we get real personal because it's Valentine's Day. We'll talk about
get up close and personal and professional.
Yeah,
just like DC.
Yep.
I'm Adriel Lewis. I am a curator at the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Center. I guess like the easiest way to explain that to people who haven't been to the Smithsonian or DC is like everybody knows that the African American History and Culture Museum opened recently, and so we're kind of like the like in the little frog eggs. So we're not tadpoles yet even, and we're definitely not a frog if like the museum was the frog, right? And so we're at like this pre-birth period, and we're thinking about you know, what would a museum look like that would appeal to a larger audience of not just people of Asian and Pacific Islander descent, but just folks in general who, you know, could learn more about the experiences of how Asia and the Pacific and the U.S. all collide culturally, you know, historically, creatively. And I think, you know, like we don't have a whole lot of movies that have been in theaters. We don't have like sitcoms, artists signed to record labels. So when you compare what we do versus like the African American History and Culture Museum, which has like, you know, speaking to, you know, years and years and years of, you know, established kind of cultural history, you know, we don't have that kind of spotlight quite yet. Right. And so before we even start trying to build a museum, we're thinking about what would that culture even look like? So yeah, that's kind of generally what we do. And so the culture labs that you talk about are basically these kinds of pop-ups. Like I think the first episode of this podcast, you were talking about how, like, you know, places like Brothers and Sisters and Meketo, it's really like, let's start the conversation and then get people to, you know, like respond to it. And then from there we get a sense of, okay, this is what you want this to be. Let's make it, right? And so I think similarly, the APA Center, we're doing that, but with museums.
I remember, you know, we went to go see you speak at an event, mm-hmm. and you had compared your work to kind of listening to an amazing album. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the metaphor, but maybe you remember the metaphor that you could say it so eloquently again.
You can pull up his speech right now.
yeah. no, it's a, I think I was saying like a curator is like a DJ.
Yeah.
So I started my job in 2013. And it was my first, it continues to be my first job as a curator and in the museum world. But 2013, like the word curate wasn't really the word that it is now. You know, like everybody, like I'm a curate my pizza, right?
Yeah.
and so when I was excited that I got the job, I was telling all my friends that I'm a curator, and then they were like, what does that even mean, right? And so I think that a lot of, like, I like to see myself as kind of one of the first people at the Smithsonian, at least, who was hired during this time that the word curator became something that belonged to the people as opposed to something that belonged to the institutions. And so I've been trying to kind of form what I do based on the responses of people. And so kind of like how a DJ, you know, like you might come in to your set with a list, but if like the people aren't moving, you might really want to play the song. You're like, I dig the song. They got to hear the song. But if you know that, you know, you're trying to incite a response, sometimes you know, it's a conversation, right? You've got to respond to folks. And so I think similarly with exhibitions, I've been thinking about, well, how do we, you know, normally at the Smithsonian, an exhibit will take like, you know, 4, 5, 6 years to put together. And so, you know, you can't really respond quickly to what people are talking about right now. And so the culture labs are, you know, super fast. They happen over the course of a weekend. They're curated over the course of like 6 to 9 months. And they're made to be like kind of rapid prototype, you know, different each time. And we learn, and I think we get better each time too.
Is there anybody doing what you're doing as far as what Culture Lab, I guess, does?
Yeah. And I think this is like actually a good tie into just this whole idea of the foreign national, right? Because a lot of what we do is, you know, interestingly enough, you know, coming from the Smithsonian, people think of us as like the archetype of what a museum should be. But my inspiration, all my favorite art spaces kind of are more in the places that aren't recognized in the art world usually. And especially when I started traveling around Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, you have like in Vietnam and in Singapore, like old military barracks and things that have been converted into artist studios and galleries. And so there's like this history that you kind of can't not address. And that immediately makes it something that's pressing and social. But at the same time, it kind of, like, I think takes people out of the element so that they're not expecting it to be like whatever they think a museum experience is supposed to be. And so our culture labs have taken place, like in New York, we did the old site of the Pearl River Mart, which, yeah, you know, like for a lot of folks who've lived in New York, that's like an iconic space where people would like buy their pocky sticks and stuff in Soho.
Oh, my Asian food mats that my grandma used to always have. It took me a long time for me to finally throw them away, but Eric would always kind of dig them up. And I was like, no, they remind me of my grandma.
With
ladies spinning their little umbrella. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Love those. Mm-hmm. It just reminds me of my grandma. But yeah, like that place had everything there. So I remember when I heard it was closing down. So when I saw that one of your cultural labs was at that Pearl River Mart, I thought that was really...
Didn't I buy some dragon heads there way back in the day?
Yes, you did. You did. You did buy some dragon heads.
If you bought dragon heads and you didn't buy them online, you probably bought them at Pearl River.
I definitely bought them there.
Or they were like the Amazon shipping point for them. Who knows?
I mean,
working with an institution like Smithsonian, how do you get that type of leeway and almost, I mean, creative freedom to be able to do something with such fast turnover? And honestly, I like the impact of the exhibits that you've done and the cultural labs that you've done is like so strong and part of the conversation. So where do you get that, I guess, the ability to be able to do so within an institution like Smithsonian?
I'm sure you experienced this in, like, you know, in the food world, where if you just talk to people in the food world, like if you just talk to restaurateurs and chefs and things like that, you'll have a very specific kind of idea of what food is and should be and could be, right? And then you talk to someone who, like, maybe has never made a reservation to a restaurant before, and you actually learn a lot about how people think about food. You know, people eat food every day, even though, you know, like, not everybody would consider themselves a foodie. And I think in the same way, you know, like, when I hear people say, I'm not into art, it's like, well, you know, you make your decisions based on design decisions, based on aesthetic decisions, and so you are. But I think people imagine kind of like these quiet galleries where people are walking with their hands behind their backs and looking at stuff. Art is like something that, like, I don't get, right? That's what a lot of people say. But I came up in the art scene in the Bay, especially in Oakland. And I didn't go to museums often, but I was always at art stuff. I was, like, at poetry slams. I was at, you know, like, hip-hop battles and, you know, car shows, flea markets.
Did you participate in the hip-hop battles, or you were just there in the audience?
I tried to be a rapper in high school, and then, you know, I just couldn't get rhythm, and so I became a spoken word artist.
Yeah, sounds like me trying to be a skateboarder.
But I would go to them, and I think that, you know, the thing about hip hop that continues to inform everything I do is that it's participatory and it's self-taught, right? And I think similarly, you go to Southeast Asia, you go to, you know, any part of the global South, really, and that's how people experience art and history and culture. You know, like they'll have museums and you go there and then they might be well attended, but oftentimes they're not. But then, like, down the street will be like this block party and people have paintings, they're making food, they're dancing. And then, you know, when I came to the museums, I realized, I was like, y'all are doing a lot of paperwork and a lot of steps to basically try to emulate what people just kind of do on the street, right? And so I think, to answer your question, a lot of what I've been thinking about is, you know, like, how do we just kind of reach out to the audiences that maybe other museums haven't been looking at, but that I know based on my experience, you know, like living in Oakland, living in Brooklyn, living in Beijing, DC, that there is like this critical mass of people who are super engaged in art, but they just don't find it on museums. Maybe they just, like, you know, they look at murals on the streets, or they, like, look at, you know, like, Juxtapose or things like that. And right now I feel like museums are just starting to kind of catch on to that.
One of the interesting things you said in your opening was kind of comparing what you do, or kind of what the APA, and kind of it's in its infancy stage, and comparing it to the African American History Museum, right? Mm-hmm. Talking about how they have this rich dialogue and catalog of information and culture and history that it's able to be put into a museum versus, you know, that doesn't really exist for in the APA world. But to me, like, which I kind of said at the beginning, is, you know, the Asian diaspora story has been a huge part of American history almost in identical amount of years, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So where is this, you know, the disconnect really kind of connected with me, and I'm sure this is what you'll delve into, is, you know, my experience as a Chinese American, Taiwanese American specifically, is so different than my wife's experience as a Cambodian American. Yeah. And then even how, like, our cultures speak or relate to each other, the way my mom communicates with her mom and the way her mom reacts to my mom, and, you know, obviously my opinion is that kind of disconnect between within all of our own cult, to me, it's like we're all Asian here.
Yeah,
doesn't
yeah,
matter
yeah.
if we're Vietnamese or Korean or Chinese. Like, yeah. In the context of where we live now, we need to recognize that we're just Asians,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I think things would progress more.
Uh-huh.
But I think our disinterest or disconnect between each other culturally is why APA today is, you know, still in its infancy. And then
yeah, yeah.
There's this amazing Museum of African American History.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, like, if and when we do open up a museum that's at the Smithsonian or not, that's like kind of dedicated to all of this that you're talking about, I don't even know if it would be called Asian Pacific American. I mean, like, like, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have never heard that term Asian Pacific American. Maybe they've heard Asian American, but even that is like only a couple of decades old mm-hmm. of a term. And you know, I think that as soon as you step into that realm of trying to compare whatever, you know, an Asian Pacific American culture or narrative might look like with, you know, African American culture or Latino culture, like you're already on the wrong foot because mm-hmm. the way that we would even, you know, like package, wrap this history, begin the conversation of this history is hella different, right? Like, I mean, just the term Asian American is in a lot of ways a choice, right? Where, you know, it's not like we were taken from a bunch of different countries and forced to come to this country the way that folks in different African countries did during the time of slavery. But at the same time, it's not like, you know, we're not just like a bunch of expats coming from different parts of Europe because, like, you know, we felt like it either, you know, and, you know, and there's definitely like Eastern European folks who have, you know, very similar experiences. I would say more similar to like Asian immigrant experiences than like Western European experiences, right? And so I think for me, you know, even though I studied Asian American studies, I was born and raised in the Bay. You know, like when I started actually traveling around Asia and interacting with folks, I feel like that's when everything really clicked with me. And I'm more interested in this idea of diaspora. And, you know, and I think that American culture is still a critical piece in that, even though we're not geographically part of Asia, just because you go anywhere in Asia and, you know, like, for better or worse, there's American culture, you know, there, right? Like, it's through like food that was introduced to the through the military, or like music that was introduced via pop culture or whatever, you know, like in Southeast Asia, like the language that's used, or in a lot of places internationally, the language that's used to communicate among folks is English, right? And so where does that all fit? And I think the way that people typically see the Smithsonian and our national museums is like, it's got to be stuff that happened in the 50 states, right? And then we can't really look at our culture just contained within the 50 states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I only triggered that question because I know that you have some very specific things, Zeta, that you want to ask him.
I try not to disagree with you on that one. I find it the opposite, actually, of what you were saying, is that people tend to loop all of the Asian Americans into one, mm-hmm. and that I actually feel the need to be able to create a separation and a different identity for everyone, because the Chinese American experience is different from the Cambodian diaspora experience. And, you know, one thing that I've really like to emphasize too, when I have these conversations, or if it comes up, I don't really walk up to somebody and start initiating conversations about Cambodian diaspora, but you know, I don't say Cambodian immigrants. I specifically say Cambodian diaspora or refugees, because that mm-hmm. experience is different, and that is really shaped mm-hmm. who I am and who my kids will be, you know, along the way.
Yeah, and I mean, Cambodia specifically, like, you have the whole exilers community over in Cambodia, and like, to me, that's like a community of Asian Americans that are all just living in Cambodia because of the circumstance of deportation.
Have you watched Cambodian Sun?
Yeah, my homies made that film. And
yes, because gosh, I forgot what her name
Anita,
is.
Anita Yali.
Yes, Anita. She produced her and is in the mm-hmm. film, and she represented that artist Kosal Akio, but mm-hmm. I honestly, it's one of my most favorite documentaries. It's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. His spoken word is so beautiful. Like, I mean, from beginning to end, it's such a great documentary and a story about him, mm-hmm. and the way it develops to the end is completely unexpected too, in its own way, that there's so many layers to the identity of a Cambodian. You know, I don't know. And
what is this Cambodian exile situation for our deportation for our listeners?
So this is an issue that's you know, not unique to Cambodia, but there is some particularity in the way that it plays out in Cambodia because of certain policies and agreements between the Cambodian government and the U.S. You were asking me and not Seda, right? Because I feel like Seda's going to weigh more than me.
I do know at this very moment, you know, the current prime minister in Cambodia was a big fan of Donald Trump, of course, right? But I think one disagreement that he did have was that he was no longer going to accept any more Cambodian deportees at this moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that is a most recent current thing.
So. Interesting. I mean, so I was kicking it with Casal over in Phnom Penh a couple years ago.
I tried to reach
ago.
Out to him, like, hi.
Ah, he is elusive, an elusive person.
I can tell. I can see that.
But like, you know, when I was out there, it was interesting because this particular, you know, like so in a lot of deportation situations, you know, like and you know, this is similar in Mexico and Vietnam, is like you have these folks who you know, came with their families as refugees, and they were like really, really super duper young, like babies and toddlers, raised in the kinds of situations that I think oftentimes when one has to flee their country, they don't land in the suburbs. You know, they end up in refugee camps, they end up in low income housing, and then they become susceptible to a lot of the social situations of that, right? And so you have folks who grew up banging, folks who were involved in petty crimes, sometimes violent crimes, and folks who have felonies. And so Casal is an example of someone who he got in trouble, he did his time, and then after he got out, where typically you get out, you served your time, and then you just move on, he got out of jail and then got deported, right? And so you have this entire exilers community of folks who, they don't speak Khmer, they don't have a namesake in Cambodia, so they can't get a job, and then they just get deported back to Cambodia, right? And then so, but I guess on the other end of that, one of the things that you know, is really inspiring is that you have folks who were deported and now they've begun like nonprofit organizations, they've become record labels, they've begun, you know, like organizations to help deportees, you know, down to the point where, like, when I was out there, there was someone who was arriving, and it was an event. Like, all these exilers were like gonna greet this person and just like welcome them into the fold and kind of show them, you know, here are the places where you can order in English, you know, here's the round table pizza that finally opened up, you know, things like that. And so, you know, that all that is like, it's in this kind of like gray area that like I feel like isn't part of the mission of like the National Museum of American History, because it's happening in Cambodia, but it's also not part of the Freer Sackler, because that's like ancient Asian art, right? And so
like, we always got so excited when there was like a piece of Angkor art and we're like, oh my god, Cambodia's here in DC.
yeah like I see you.
Yeah. We're like, this piece of art, this is us right here. But yeah, not necessarily. No, I mean, I really, really loved the story, and I went to, I don't want to say love as if it's like a positive thing, but I like it because it shows how complex the Asian American community here is. And, you know, my sister is of Casal's generation. She's a refugee baby. Mm-hmm. And, you know, compared to him and a lot of probably, you know, places that, like the Bronx, Lowell, Long Beach, you know, in the DMV, you know, even with the TRGs and the whatnot, a lot of our community kind of grew out of that a little bit. You know, we're lucky as Cambodian Americans in Northern Virginia in the DMV area. But you know, it's always an interesting conversation. But when I saw Cambodian Sun here at that, I don't remember what theater it was,
like
here
East
in Georgetown.
Cinema,
I think it was that one. We had someone in that generation actually stand up and say, I have a question. Mostly like, wasn't a comment, it was like her own statement that she was. She's like, you know, I'm of his generation. That's not my problem. He does not represent me. Uh-huh. He had a choice. Huh. And like, even our own Cambodians have to fight to understand, like, no, this could have been you. You know, my parents became citizens because they had the resources around them and the support to understand what that process is. And you think about people like Casal's family and a lot of the deportees and Cambodians that are living in exile whose families didn't have the resources and the support to be able to understand what that process was.
I mean, you, like, I think that's one of the big dilemmas is like, you know, as a Asian American, Asian Pacific American, you know, even like people of color community, like, we don't want to be generalized, but we do want the coalition, right? And so there is this point where you do have to, there has to be some kind of understanding of a singular unit. But, you know, I think where typically people see that as like a box, I see it as just kind of like, you know, a bunch of squiggly lines that kind of go all over the place, right? Like, people always ask, like, well, if you're at the Asian Pacific American Center, like, does Turkey count? You know, and I think that, you know, like, it's not appropriate for us to define that, you know, Like, for me, that's where the conversation gets to happen, you know, and we're never going to arrive at a point where we're like, now everything's put in its place. Everything's been given a name. Everything's been defined, right? Like, the borders keep on shifting and expanding, you know, and to me, that's interesting. I mean, that's what means that people, you know, people who are in the field of this kind of cultural studies will always have a job because, you know, culture begets culture, right? And I guess the other side of that where, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, like, it pisses me off whenever people assume that I'm, you know, an ethnicity that I'm not, or, you know, generalize as Asians. But at the same time, there's no doubt, like, I've been watching, like, the Winter Olympics and, like, you know, feeling hella proud watching Chloe Kim, right? And I'm like, I'm not Korean, but, like, you know, there's no,
we're like,
question.
12 Asians.
Yes, exactly, right? Yeah, I'm interested in, like, how, you know, because a lot of Asian Americans listen to K-pop, and definitely a lot of folks in South Korea are, like, influenced by American pop culture. But I think to actually have, like, just this contingency of Asian American Olympians go over to South Korea and compete and become kind of like these household names, the ways that people in Asia maybe are used to seeing, like, Michael Phelps and stuff like that. It's going to be a trip to see what happens, you know. So
yeah, and you know, being on that topic too, it's true, because I think all of us growing up, every time we saw that one Asian person, we're like, yes, an Asian person, that's us right
now. Apollo.
Yeah, or like, what was that basketball player that's really popular, the really tall guy?
Yao Ming.
There you go. Sorry, I'm sure there's more of you out there, but
we got so excited,
like a really popular one. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, because it's like, for me, it's like, don't link me with a Chinese merit. But at the same time, when you grow up and you see a lot of faces that are not like yours, and when you see the one, you know, you get really excited. But to me, what that means is, like, the more that we see faces that are similar to ours out there, mm-hmm. is the opportunity for us to define who we are. Mm-hmm. You know, it's mm-hmm. almost like, I mean, maybe a small example, but we won't get into it. But like Black Panther, mm-hmm. Does that represent all of Africa or all of Black identity? No. But having that face, the faces out there that is that's out there in common, and you know, like, it's in such a powerful way, mm-hmm. we get, you know, you get to define who you are.
Yeah. And I think that idea of defining who you are is what makes what I'm super interested in my job, because I feel like a lot of times, you know, because especially for our generation, you know, we've grown up with, like, Black culture embedded in who we are, right? But there's also certain things that we just don't have rights to claim, right? And I think that's what a lot of us are yearning for, is like something that's dope that we can also claim to our culture, mm-hmm. right? And it sucks that, like, the things that are really dope oftentimes become stereotypes, and so you can't just be like, you know, martial arts, because people are like, oh, well, of course, right? But it's just like, martial arts is dope, you know, like, I mean, who's gonna argue with that, right? And so it's like how do you find ways to claim it in your own terms? Because what I think that we don't want to do is be like, oh, we need, like, an Asian American version of Black Panther, or we need an Asian American version of this other thing that's been, you know, created and developed in other communities, right? And it doesn't mean that we can't be in conversation with those things. It doesn't mean that we can't incorporate elements of things. But I think at the same time, you know, like, you know, we have every right to begin culture, you know, from day one, you know, or pull from things that have been in existence but maybe haven't been noticed. I think one of the reasons why, like, Maketo is a place I love going to is because it's not a version of something else. Like, it just is what it is. And, like, when I, like, sat down there, it just felt like, oh, someone that knows the kind of things I'm into from based on experience may have made this. Or, like, when I came here, Brothers and Sisters, and I ordered, like, the octopus hot dog, right? And I was like, I'm gonna go to this restaurant, you know, like, I had to make a reservation, gonna order this hot dog. But it was delicious, like, my favorite thing. And it's just because, like, it felt like, I don't know if I've ever had an octopus hot dog, but it felt like I had, like, it felt like comfort food while I was eating it. And I feel like there's something there that's, like, not quite defined that we're all trying to figure out right now. And I think, like, you're right, Seda, like, the more things that we make, you know, the more we'll kind of get at this idea of what that is. And the less we'll start to, like, look at any single thing as something that's supposed to represent everything. Like, that person you mentioned, I think the reason why they reacted strongly is because maybe they've never seen, like, a Cambodian American on a big screen before. And then so if you've gone your whole life never seeing that, when you do see it, you want it to be you, And any time it veers from anything that you feel like, you know, could represent you or that misrepresents you, then you, you know, react adversely to that.
I'm really glad that you said Maketo is what it is, because I feel like there's always this need to define what Maketo is. It just is. Yeah, just come in and
oh
just
my
order
God.
Something.
The
just
internal
is.
Company conversations about Maketo are driving me nuts. The, you know, what was interesting, and I know because I think there is such a close tie to kind of modern Asian American cultural identity to Black culture, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's just a lot of feelings about that and mm-hmm. how people feel about it. I know that my wife particularly has some really strong feelings about how kind of like Eddie Huang's story and how he uses Black culture to mm-hmm. define his, how he used that to kind of figure out his own Asian identity. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, what I really thought was interesting from your introduction, just talking about travel, because I actually sent this picture to Zeta yesterday about this rap battle happening in Taipei, and mm-hmm. the flyer was very intense, right?
But he also sent me a series of photos of ice skating faces.
Yes,
those are like, which one is he bringing up?
Two serious Texas. But then, you know, I've been reading these articles about how hip hop culture is really disrupting politics in China, particularly mm-hmm. where there's all of these young Chinese rappers who, you know, are learning about, you know, finding music from the States and really disrupting their own political culture there through the thing of hip hop, where I think like if that happens here, it turns into this whole story about appropriation, mm-hmm. yada, yada, mm-hmm. yada. But then it's what hip hop meant to African American in the 80s and late 70s and how that changed and self-identity and a disruption of politics and government and social economic issues. You see it in other countries. You see it a lot in Southeast Asia. You see it a lot in China, where they're using this vehicle of hip hop mm-hmm. to disrupt their social norms, mm-hmm. right? And this has become a vessel to change art and disrupt social norms. And, you know, I think like that kind of dichotomy is so fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, like, I know that in past episodes you've talked about like kind of that the differences and similarities between like appropriation and appreciation. It's like something that a lot of folks are figuring out right now. I think one thing that's clear is that like the definitions of all that are up for grabs, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I will say is that this idea of an art form coming from outside of Asia and disrupting things is definitely not new. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the first things I learned about was, like, the history of just, like, art in general in Asia. Because, you know, like, I mean, we've been making art, or what we now call as art, for a long time. But for a while, we weren't calling it art. We were just making just the most beautiful tables. Right, or like just like really beautiful wardrobes, or like, you know, really
snuff bottles.
Yeah,
thousands of years of beautiful European snuff bottles.
Yeah, but it was like never with the intention of it being like this is going to be in a museum one day, right? And then it wasn't until like Western contact that people started coming in and just being like, oh, that thing that you've been doing for generations, we call that art, right? And so, you know, when you have like, you know, like cubism that you know, like went from Europe to you know, to Asia, when you have like, you know, the Dada art movement coming, you know, like all these different art movements that would go into Asia, you know, it was really interesting because it's like on one end there are cultural elements that are coming from countries that may have colonized those countries, but at the same time, because they were so, you know, like some of these artists would grab on to these sorts of Western art because they were like, If I don't do this, then everybody's just expecting me to just like do brushstrokes of storks, right? And then so, and I think it's the same thing with like music. It's like to this day, 2017, you know, you walk down the street and you say, "Tell me what you think Asian music sounds like," right? And then they'll start, you know, like thinking, yeah, exactly, like that one ringtone, right? And so it's like, I mean, I think that in order for people to actually be able to create something different, I mean, I definitely know people in Beijing that are making like experimental noise music that doesn't sound like it came from anywhere except for their studio, because it's incredibly experimental, right? And so I think something like that, yes, you could say that that's purely no appropriation involved whatsoever, but it's not going to get radio play. It's not going to get distributed and have that kind of like virality that something like hip hop does, right? And so I think right now with a lot of the movements happening in Asia, picking up like hip hop, you know, picking up other forms of like pop music, that's a kind of an interesting exchange. And I think one thing I would throw in there is just like, you know, Kanye, Pharrell, like they brought Murakami into the fold, you know, like, I mean, that with Eddie Huang is interesting just because like, you know, a scene that I find really interesting in Fresh Off the Boat is like, you know, like he's rapping, he's doing Shimmy Shimmy Ya, ODB, but ODB is from Wu-Tang Clan, which got their thing from Chinese culture. And then so it's just like this really messy kind of back and forth kind of a thing where like, yes, appropriation is definitely involved. But at the same time, you know, like try to imagine hip hop without Wu-Tang Clan, you mm-hmm. know, so.
Or Chinese culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Asian culture.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear that guy's name, and I'm just like, my wife wants to blow up.
She freezes up. I know you had so many questions you want to ask him.
No, I'm just like, you bring up that name, Eddie Huang, and I'm like, you know, I'm about to walk out the door.
I'm just staring at I can't stop staring at the host stand right now.
On the record now that this guy, I have a problem with him. But anyway,
let me actually bring.
We're gonna drop the bomb.
Oh.
That was the Eddie Huang problem.
So one thing I did want to make sure I brought up because I feel like this is importantly relevant. Just making up words. My grandfather owned a restaurant, and that's kind of how my family got out of Hong Kong.
Okay.
My grandfather and great grandfather actually opened up Chinese restaurants in Mexico, so that's why I have like a Spanish last name. And then they like my grandfather rendezvoused with the rest of my family all in San Francisco. And then there he opened up a restaurant. It wasn't a Chinese restaurant, but it was like an American restaurant. This is like brothers and sisters. Like it's an American restaurant,
Grandpa,
but like the favorite dish. And, you know, like I thought about this because you were talking about kind of like, you know, running in the back of the kitchens as a kid and stuff. Right. And like, that's what I used to do. Right. And, but the dish that my grandfather served, he served mostly like, you know, non-Asian audience, was rice with gravy and maybe a hamburger patty on the side for like a quarter. And it was like, you know, just like a restaurant in San Francisco that folks would just kind of go to. And it's like, he didn't call it Chinese fusion, but, it was called American food, you know, and, you know, but it was also something that like, you know, it's just so distinctly a part of like what I remember growing up and eating. So
what was the name of that restaurant?
I don't even remember. And I tried to ask my dad and he said, you know, like he doesn't remember, you know, cause like I was just like a little kid at the time. My grandfather's not around anymore. And so I need to find that out and I'll put that in your show.
What would be the timeline from Hong Kong to Mexico?
So my great grandfather moved like way before my dad was even born. And I think my grandfather was too. And so my dad was born in the 60s. And so, yeah, like, I think in Mexico, I think it was probably like the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And then they all moved to the US in the 70s. My great grandfather stayed in Mexico, started like a whole new family there. So there's like a family out there with like, they're like 3/4 Mexican, but their last name is Fong. And I'm like, we should trade last names.
I always like to tell this story about Tokyo Underground because it's related. Mm-hmm. It was like we had just been open for like 6 months, and it was obviously really busy, but it was just full of foodies and DC people. We still hadn't really hit it with the Asians yet. We had a lot of Asians coming, and they're like, New York, New York, which is fine. I didn't care. We were busy. But I remember one day a bus pulls up, and like 30 Japanese businessmen come out, and I was like, oh my God, we made it. The Japanese tourists know about us. Like, we're so legit. And they come up, and I had one Japanese server, and I was like, Hiro, go serve these people.
Of course his name is
Hiro. Yeah, I was like, Hiro, go serve them. And he goes up there, and he's like, why is that much, blah, 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 blah. And they turn around, and they're like, oh, no, 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 no Japanese. And they were all Mexican. And it was like Asian-born Mexicans, and they only spoke Spanish, and they looked just like Japanese business people. And I was like,
whoa.
Damn it, I still haven't made it. But you know, I wonder like what takes someone from Hong Kong to, you know, Mexico, and then from Mexico to.
I don't know. Probably it was easier to get in I mean, it was probably based on networks and mm-hmm. things like that. I feel like every time I go home for the holidays, I learn like
one more fact.
Yeah, yeah, right? One more thing. And then sometimes it'll be like a big thing. It's like, oh yeah, by the way, you had this distant uncle that was like super rich and then lost it all in gambling.
Right? Yeah. So like I'm like same. It's like and then you're like, oh, tell me more. And they're like, next year.
Yeah.
They're like, what do you mean next year?
Like, it's 8:45. I must get ready for bed. Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently, my grandmother's brother, who you've met, the really funny pie, mm-hmm. they somehow in the 70s they opened a grocery store in Lagos. They just like, they're from Hong Kong and they're like, we're gonna go open a grocery store in Lagos. I'm like,
wow,
what?
Yeah.
How does that connection
Everybody's
happen?
Gonna die one day. Can we just share all of the information, please?
I know. I mean, there's definitely like a big you know, Chinese population in Mexico City. Like there is in many places throughout the world, I guess. And so I don't know. I mean, I know that it was my great grandfather first, and then he mm-hmm. got my grandpa. And so my dad, you know, like had, you know, like the first time he saw his dad was when he was 7. The second time was when he was 14, when he came to like move with them to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but that, you know, that experience sticks with me because of my last name. And so, you know, even though in a lot of ways my experience is a very kind of like, you know, Asian American upbringing in a very diverse area in the Bay, you know, things like that. I think the fact that I have like this, you know, like Hebrew first name, Spanish last name, everybody thinks I'm Filipino, you know, like it's just the way that I get approached when people, especially over email, like people, I don't even know what people think I like imagine when I'm like, when they receive the first email from me is like, Lewis, Adriel, Smithsonian curator. It's like, but yeah.
And then you roll up in your rose pants and
I mean, yeah, you always like, look amazing.
tatted Asian guy like the rest of us. So, yeah.
Okay, so we do always end up kind of wrapping this thing up with talking about snacks. Oh. And
I mean, before we even get to my snack question, the whole rice and gravy and hamburger thing.
Oh yeah, we do need to talk about that.
I still eat that.
I mean, it's starting to become a thing, but I really think we need to legitimately do this as a foreign national cookbook of like.
Oh, we should catalog these. Jack, what do you think?
Yes, absolutely.
We should make the guests put a recipe up.
It's going to be like rice. Yeah,
only if it comes with a snack, though. The recipe has to come with a snack also.
Yeah, I mean, it's like one of the stories I tell is spaghetti and meatball night, right? So, and my mom still coincidentally does Mondays. She still has spaghetti. Wonderful neighbor who kind of looks out over my mom always invites her on Mondays for spaghetti and meatball night. Mm-hmm. But we used to have spaghetti and meatball night with my family, and it was very rare that we had any meals together, mm-hmm. Especially as a teenager because I was so busy. But we'd have these kind of one-off spaghetti and meatball nights, and we never had spaghetti. It was always rice, mm-hmm. red sauce, and meatballs, mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. what spaghetti and meatballs is to me in the context of this country.
I feel like red sauce and ketchup is like the reverse of sriracha. It's like all these people will be putting sriracha on everything, and then the Asians were like, but we put ketchup on things that should have sriracha on it, you know. Snacks. I mean, you were talking about like chips, like nacho cheese and chip bags.
Snacking is a part of her her identity, I think, than her cultural identity.
Let me tell you a little bit of why snacks are so important to me.
All right.
So I know it's kind of like a half joke, and it's a great way to tie it up at the end, kind of get to know a little bit about sometimes these secret guilty pleasures of people. I think that's always kind of a little bit of the interesting thing.
Yeah.
Jack, I'm still giving you an opportunity to redeem yourself.
I did. Remember popcorn. Takis. I changed my answer. Yeah. It's Takis. Uh-huh,
I'm sure. Have you ever mixed them together with the smart?
Yeah, you should. That's true.
A good one. The dust mix of the Takis are great. But the snacking thing has always been a special thing because my earliest memories are Doritos and Gatorade or Doritos and like a Nest tea or what is that? The little Brist tea. Mm-hmm. My grandma always take me down to the bodega. Mm-hmm. She get her little lottery ticket. I get a bag of chips and a can of soda. What age you would actually get your kid a soda? I mean, my goodness, I don't even know why and how, but she did. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, I had such good memories about chips. Like, something my dad and I shared. And I love, like, if I ever got a chance to go to an American friend's house, I would love to look into their pantry. It was just, like, so dreamy for me.
Even still now, like, I do these amazing, like, these crazy private dinners in people's homes. Uh-huh. And I think to me, one day the symbol of wealth, like,
when, is the pantry. When that's her
and
what
I, when I look at my wife and I'm gonna go, we finally made it. Is there's gonna be a room for my snacks?
Yes.
For my kids.
Yes.
And my snacks.
I feel like we slowly kind of have
one
it
room
now,
for
but
your
I
kids
don't.
Snacks or one room because
now
kids
I'll have like a
I've seen houses where
pretzels.
It's like this is this is the small room for just the kids' snacks because we have three kids that go to private school. And here's Jack's snacks because he's particular. Here's Amy's snacks because, you know, she doesn't eat dairy, right?
Well, it always amazed me because, like, these families would still always go grocery shopping, but I would open the pantry. I'm like, but you guys have all this food. What are you grocery shopping for? Mm-hmm, like, to us, it was like week by week, we went to the grocery store and that's what we made for the week. But no, the pantry thing, it almost is like a little bit of sign of a wealth thing. For now, we kind of have backed up like pretzels and stuff for the kids.
Okay.
But, you know, it's like thinking of the American people.
Mm-hmm. They don't have to go to
Bodega. It is appliances and snacks. Mm-hmm. Appliances and snacks, to me, that's what I kind of envision in my head. Okay. But snacks are important to me. I mean, like, that's what we would go to the 7-Eleven or that neighborhood ice cream truck. You get the Doritos, you pump the chili and the cheese. Yeah. It was like a treat. You get a little bit of money and you go to the get a snack. But what's your favorite snack?
So I can tell you, you know, like what I used to snack on and what I snack on now, which, you know, because, you know, just coming up in life, I don't snack on the same things. Like back in the day, so you talked about nacho cheese and like chips. I used to do that with like Red Hot Cheetos for sure. Like, so what I did like in high school, like I got $5 a day for lunch money and I would save it up. So that every 2 weeks, I would have enough money to like buy like a, you know, just like an overpriced Fat Farm t-shirt or something. And then so I was like, how do I only spend a dollar each day? And so I would like either buy Red Hot Cheetos and like pump it with cheese. Or if I really wanted to save money, I would buy Funyuns and then put ranch in it. Mm. And then if I really wanted to save money, like for some reason, my high school just had like they didn't have Taco Bell, but they did have like the packets of Taco Bell hot sauce. And like mild sauce.
Okay.
So,
yeah. And so like if I really just wanted to like save money and like not spend any money, I would just kind of like just eat the sauce, which is probably terrible. So
it's kind of tight.
Just eat the sauce, dog. You know, like it's not drinking the sauce.
I need a hit of flavor real quick, get my day going.
Hit of flavor, a little sodium, you know, just enough to get you to Mr. Rags so you can, you know. And so now, man, so you were talking about my culture lab in Honolulu. So I was going to Hawaii a bunch last year, and their snack game is crazy. Like there's this place called Latour Bakery that they have these packaged furikake rice puffs that are just like off the hook. And so like when I knew it was gonna be like my last trip for a long time, I basically filled up an entire suitcase with like those, and then I kind of like eat like one a day, you know. Like there's like a whole bag that got stale. Like I always do that. I go somewhere and then I buy these snacks that you can't find in the States.
Yep,
and then they're so precious though. Like they end up like going bad before I finish them.
That's like these like taro.
Yeah, we buy these like taro.
Taro cakes
with the mochi ball in the middle at the every time I go to Asian airports.
One specific brand that is better than the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we had Honeycomb, I'd buy like $600-$700 worth of snacks, and then we would sell it at Honeycomb. Mm-hmm. But I would charge so much because I didn't really want. I'd be like an antique store.
I didn't really want
anyone to buy them because I was like, well, in the last week it might go bad. We're just gonna have to eat them. But then everyone would be like, oh my God, you have this at the store.
Wow, out to me for buying the shrimp chips at Honeycomb.
Yeah, we're like, that's for $20, you can have this banana chocolate covered thing.
Yeah. So if not, we'll eat it.
People did it, though, because they were like, we do really want this. You have it.
I'd be like, $50.
It's like, you need to earn it. How bad do you want it?
So next time I'll just be like, if I go to a grocery store with like, you know, super nice, but, you know, kind of pricey things, I'll be like, I'll pay half price and I'll split it with you.
Yeah. Done. <Nice. laughs> What a real honor and a real treat to have you.
Yeah, it's fun, man.
And, you know, thank you for listening to our prior shows. I think that was amazing. And it's been really great and special to have you in our lives. And I know Zeta feels the same way. And for me, you know, I was saying this to my wife earlier and how I need to find other ways to think every day because my brain is so dialed in sometimes that I can't relax. You know, thank you for doing what you do, and I know you'll continue to challenge our community and ask us to step up and find new ways to communicate with each other and share through what we do, and I'm glad that I'm part of that journey with you, and I know that we both really appreciate you. in your work.
You. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, when I don't like to look at menus before I go to restaurants that I am excited to eat at, and so I didn't look at the Brothers and Sisters menu, but you know, we were staying in a room, and it was reading write-ups about it, and it was like, you know, this is Eric Bruner Yang's first American food restaurant, and I was like, okay, so it's gonna be like, you know, his take on like McCormick's Grill, and it just I can't eat. I mean, I can see where you're going with it, but I can't even put in words the joy in my heart when I looked at the menu and like everything had like at least like some mochi in it or like this and that, because I'm like, even when I make Italian food at home, I gotta put like some roe. Or like something.
Yeah.
Come in your house for that.
Yeah, and I think the menu will only kind of get broader and bigger as we explore. And and like, even though it pains me sometimes, I get great joy of doing the back to front menu, mm-hmm. because I think Americans get so dialed in. Mm-hmm. And what happens here in America, or like even European style restaurants, really defines what the rest of the world does with their restaurants, mm-hmm. so whether it's mm-hmm. fine dining or modern this or modern that, like how Noma has, you know, that kind of Western restaurant has defined food everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's like, I remember the food critic writing about Brothers and Sisters and saying that the way the menu opened is off-putting. And I was like,
that
go tell the, you know, a billion people in the world.
That come to America and have to, and still struggle.
That come to America
read.
And have to do it the opposite direction,
yeah,
you know?
Dude.
And so,
No, you should be like, go ask the Smithsonian curator.
Yeah.
Well, he loves my octopus taco.
I'm sorry that one thing bothered you. Like, do you know what everybody else deals with every day? My goodness.
Yeah. So, so we're happy to kind of push a little bit what it means to be Western and what it means to be American with the restaurant. And I'm glad that you feel it.
Word.
Thank you for coming today.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's the cue music. Poo-poo. Pew-pew.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.